Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear from Christopher Jones-Cruz, Brian Lynn, Phil Dierking, and Katie Weaver. Jill Robbins will tell us what's trending today, and John Russell will bring us this week's education report. But first, here is Christopher Jones-Cruz.
Japan says Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will not apologize for his country's 1941 attack on United States forces when he visits Pearl Harbor, Hawaii later this month. Wednesday marks the 75th anniversary of the attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. Japanese warplanes dropped bombs that sunk the battleship USS Arizona. They also damaged or destroyed 20 other ships and 164 planes. More than 2,300 Americans were killed. The attack led to the American entry into World War II. The day after the attack, Congress declared war on Japan. The war ended after the U.S. military dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The two attacks killed more than 210,000 people. 6 months ago, Barack Obama became the first U.S. president to visit a memorial to the bombing in Hiroshima while still in office. Tuesday, Japan's Chief Cabinet Secretary, Yoshihide Suga, said the Prime Minister will visit Pearl Harbor on December 26th and 27th. He said Abe's visit is designed to show his commitment towards the future and to never repeat the tragedy of the World War, as well as to send a message of reconciliation between the U.S. and Japan. Abe's visit will be the first by a Japanese leader since the attack. Matthew Lindley is a professor in the Department of International Programs at Nagoya University. He said that Abe and his supporters consider the visit a sign that the two countries now have strong relations. Lindley noted that Abe was the first foreign leader to meet with Trump. The two spoke in New York last month. During the campaign, Trump criticized Japan and other nations where the U.S. military has troops. He said they should be paying more for the security the troops provide. Grant Newsham is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum on Strategic Studies. Newsham says Trump's statements while he was a candidate, suggesting that Japan was not doing enough for its defense and not paying enough for the services of U.S. forces, really frightened the Japanese government.
Since Mr. Trump was elected, to the Japanese population and the Japanese government's great surprise, the Japanese government has really been scrambling to try and build some sort of relationship with Mr. Trump. They didn't think he would win.
This week, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced plans to return to the Japanese government almost 4,000 hectares of land in Okinawa used for military training. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz.
Thank you.
As populist movements grow in Europe, it remains unclear how they will affect the European Union. Italy is the latest country to vote against its leadership. On Sunday, Italian voters rejected constitutional reforms proposed by Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. About 60% of voters rejected the reforms in a nationwide referendum. Renzi actively campaigned for the measures. He made it clear that if they were not approved, voters would be rejecting his government. Renzi accepted responsibility for the loss and offered his resignation on Monday. The proposals were meant to simplify Italy's government, centralize power, and reduce corruption. One measure would have turned the elected Senate into a much smaller appointed body. Renzi's government has supported pro-European Union policies. His defeat energized other Italian parties, including the anti-establishment Five Star Movement and anti-immigration Northern League. However, some observers say the referendum vote cannot be seen as a direct result of populist movements, such as the election of Donald Trump in the United States. Ben Wellings is an expert on the EU at Monash University in Australia. He told VOA that while the Italian result was not helpful to Europe, the EU will clearly survive.
We're not suggesting that Italy is anyway going to leave the European Union or even the Eurozone. So it's an unwanted element of instability, but I think the European Union will see this one through.
Peter Yeltsov is a political expert at the National Defense University in Washington. He says he thinks the rise of populist movements in Europe could give Russia a chance to expand its influence there.
You have a sense that Russia supports those either right-wing politicians or left-wing politicians, but mostly politicians who are skeptical of European Union, who would like to leave EU, and who would support the lifting of sanctions from Russia.
Yeltsov notes that Russian banks have provided financial support to political movements in Europe. He said the leader of France's National Front, Marine Le Pen, received a large campaign loan from a Russian-backed bank. France will hold a presidential election next year, and Yeltsov said many experts think Le Pen could win.
If she wins in France, it's my prediction it's going to be the end of European Union.
He added that in addition to financing some European politicians, Russia is using propaganda to increase its influence in the continent. Countries that may be vulnerable to such propaganda could be Greece, Italy, Spain, and Bulgaria, he said. Yeltsov said Russia may also use its financial and political influence to try to weaken the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He said this could involve trying to get some members to leave the alliance or stop efforts to join it. I'm Brian Lynn.
Thank you.
Some people in China welcomed the election of businessman Donald Trump as President of the United States. They believed he would negotiate deals helpful to both countries. But President-elect Trump's decision to speak directly with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen led the Chinese government to protest to the U.S. ambassador in Beijing. Some Chinese officials said the telephone call between Trump and Tsai violated America's 1979 pledge of support for a one-China policy. Since then, the U.S. has not had official contact with Taiwan's government. Tsai told a small group of U.S. reporters Tuesday that she did not sense a major change in U.S. policies toward Taiwan. One phone call does not mean a policy shift, Tsai said.
Trump has used social media to defend his decision to speak with Taiwan's president. On Twitter, the president-elect criticized some of China's policies. He wrote that China devalued its money to make it harder for American businesses to sell goods in the country. He said the Chinese government continues to heavily tax U.S. exports to China. And he said the Chinese military is expanding its presence in the South China Sea, all without asking the United States, in his words, if it was okay. Mark Toner is a spokesman for the U.S. State Department. He said the Chinese government called the U.S. ambassador to China on Saturday to protest Trump's contact with Taiwan's president. Toner also defended America's One China policy, which has been in effect for 37 years. It's allowed us to develop relations, frankly, closer relations with Beijing, and also to deepen our unofficial ties with Taipei, Toner said. The policy also provides economic and security benefits to the United States, he said.
Wang Dong is a political science professor at Peking University. He said Trump's tweets may be all about improving his negotiating position with the Chinese government. Trump has said he sometimes uses strong words to help him negotiate better deals later. But Wang said Trump may also be following the opinions of some Republican Party activists who want the U.S. government to take a harder position with China. The Washington Post and Wall Street Journal both reported that the telephone call between Trump and Tsai was planned weeks ago by Trump aides. And I think that gives us reason to be worried about U.S.-China relations going forward, Wang said. There has been too much wishful thinking and overly optimistic expectations about Donald Trump and China, and I think now people have to come back to reality.
John Bolton served as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President George W. Bush. Bolton said the United States needs to deal with what he called China's aggressive and belligerent claims in the South China Sea. He is reportedly under consideration for a diplomatic position with the Trump administration. On Tuesday, a Republican Party official arrived in Taiwan for a week-long visit. The official, Stefan Yates, is the party's chairman in the state of Idaho. Yates said he is not carrying any messages from Trump to Tsai. But, he said, China should respect the political reform and democratization of Taiwan, as President-elect Trump has.
Jeffrey Bader was the lead advisor on China for President Barack Obama from 2009 to 2011. He now works at the John L. Thornton China Center, part of the Brookings Institution Research Group. Bader said Trump's phone call with the Taiwan leader raises concerns about his foreign policy skills. There are serious risks posed by his failure to take briefings by government professionals, Bader said. He added that Trump appears to have little respect for the possible damage to long-time U.S. security interests. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
The government in Cameroon says its security forces did not abuse protesters during demonstrations in two areas last month. Students, teachers, and lawyers in English-speaking parts of the country were protesting the influence of the French language. A government official told VOA that Cameroon's military acted with restraint during the demonstrations and showed respect for international rules on human rights. Government spokesman Issa Chiroma said the government is investigating the protests and the actions of military officers. He noted that if the government finds evidence of wrongdoing, it will take corrective action to punish the violators. He also said that Cameroon will not accept any attempts to ruin the country's hard-earned national unity. The spokesman said he was reacting to a statement by the United States. He said the State Department released the statement on November 28. The State Department expressed concern about the deaths, injuries, and damage that resulted from protests in the capitals of Cameroon's northwestern and southwestern regions. U.S. Ambassador Michael Hoza expressed concerns over the violence. He met with Cameroon's President Paul Biya and explained that the United States respects Cameroon's history of acceptance of diversity.
And both President Biya and I agree that dialogue is the future for Cameroon. We know that there will be discussions, and we are certain that the Cameroonian people will find a solution and be able to live together in tolerance as they have for many, many years.
Cameroon has two official languages, English and French. English speakers make up about 20% of the population. Cameroon's constitution says that English and French should be equally important, However, the protesters say the two languages are not treated equally. English-speaking lawyers say some judges working in English-speaking areas have trouble speaking the language. Another issue is that the French-speaking regions operate under French civil law, but the English-speaking areas are based on English common law. Teachers have said that the government continues to send teachers that only speak French to English-speaking parts of the country. Some students in those areas are worried that they will not be able to get good jobs after they finish school. I'm Phil Dierking.
This is What's Trending Today. The online marketer, Amazon, is opening a new kind of store. It is one where people do not have to wait in long lines to buy a product. Instead, the buyers pay using their smartphones. The new store is in the American city of Seattle, Washington. It is called Amazon Go. It sells products that are normally found in a grocery store. What you will not find, however, are long lines and cashiers exchanging money. Customers must have a smartphone, an Amazon account, and a program on their smartphone, the Amazon Go app. The app makes a list of everything that customers plan to buy from the store. After customers have finished shopping, they can simply leave. Amazon says that because its new store does not require as many employees, the prices of goods will remain low. The company has been working on creating the store for 4 years. Hashtag Amazon Go became a trending topic this week on social media. One person on Twitter published a photograph of himself waiting in a very long line at a grocery store. He wrote, "I cannot wait for Amazon Go. Longest queue in history. But it may be some time before Amazon Go stores open up in other areas. Even the Seattle store is still open only to Amazon employees. The company plans to open that store to the public in early 2017. And that's what's trending today. I'm Jill Robbins.
For many refugees around the world, boredom is a fact of life. While the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, or UNHCR, works on resettling them, they wait and wait and wait. They cannot work, enroll in a school, or travel. In 2014, several Hazara refugees in Indonesia found a way to spend their time. They created an informal school for children, the Refugee Learning Center, or RLC. Asad Shadan is one of the founders of the RLC. He left Afghanistan after the Taliban threatened his family. Shadan says that starting the school was a difficult process. "We asked the UNHCR to help us with some kind of educational program for 3 months, but after getting no response, we decided to just go for it and started a class on our own with 18 kids. The school's website describes how the local and international community came together to help it grow. An Australian couple paid the rent for the school. Parents gave $2.50 each to pay for carpet, whiteboards, and other teaching materials. Women in the community volunteered to teach. The program, originally an informal class, has grown into a 6-room school with classes for adults and children. The program, Shadan explains, grew quickly. Within 6 months, we had 100 children enrolled, and now we have 200 students and 16 teachers. It gives all of us something to do. Thanks to donations over the past couple of years, RLC now has a library, English classes, and an indoor football league. For years, Indonesia has hosted refugees. It is part of a transit route for refugees and migrants going to Australia. But, Shadan says, the Indonesian government pretends that we don't exist. Indonesia has never signed the UN Refugee Convention, and it offers no formal rights to asylum seekers and refugees. In addition, the Australian government's 2013 decision to cut the number of refugees it admits, in addition to turning away ships carrying migrants, has created a backlog of refugees in Indonesia. The UNHCR reports currently almost 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers live in Indonesia. Around half of these come from Afghanistan. While waiting for resettlement, the students at RLC are trying to build skills. They like to think about the future. What we want to avoid is that, once resettled, we don't have any skills, or that kids have been wasting their formative years of their education, says Shadan. Although English is not the native language of the refugees, many speak English very well. We have a lot of time to practice, jokes Shadan. Some of the refugees are being resettled, but very slowly. Masoma Fakihi, a 20-year-old, said her family of 6 have finally received approval to go to the U.S. after more than 3 years in Indonesia. I like teaching at the school here, but I'm just about done with school for myself, I think, she said. I heard you can do anything in America, though, so really, I want to be a makeup artist. Wish me luck. I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.